This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents Hold Back the Dark by Kay Hooper, performed by Joyce Bean. The Summons. In the middle of the journey of our life, I came to myself within a dark wood where the straight way was lost. Dante Alighieri. 1. Tuesday, October 7. Olivia Castle had experienced some monster headaches in her time, but this one, she felt sure, was about to make her head quite literally explode. It had come out of nowhere, as if something had just yanked her head into an invisible tightening vise without warning. A vise with teeth. In pain, queasy and shaking, she managed to lever herself up from the couch, holding one hand against the head she was sure was about to fall off, and hardly spared a moment to wonder why she'd been on the couch. Work. She should have been at work. Shouldn't she be at work? Had she come home for lunch? She didn't remember. Her head hurt too much to keep thinking about that. She made it to the kitchen by holding on to various pieces of furniture as she passed, fighting nausea and accidentally grabbing Rex's tail when she gripped the edge of the sink.
"Wow!"
Sorry, she muttered. The headache so bad by then that her cat's cry sounded like a dozen angry crows. Her own quiet voice sounded like booming thunder in her head, and even her vision was affected in some way she didn't understand. She couldn't see the pleasant Vermont view normally visible from this window. She couldn't see any real view at all. She was seeing colors she was reasonably sure didn't exist in nature, or anywhere else, for that matter. Moving, swirling, like colorful smoke driven by a capricious breeze, opaque and translucent by turn. And everything was so damned bright. "Shouldn't sit on the counter. How many times have I told you? Didn't see you, pal? Oh, damn, what is going on?" There was a large economy-sized bottle of an OTC painkiller near the sink, just as there was one in almost every room of her small house and in her purse, with a box of extra bottles in the storage closet in case the zombie apocalypse came without warning and all the pharmacies got looted before she could get to them. Olivia closed her eyes against the unnatural brightness, fumbling the bottle open while bitterly cursing childproof caps foisted upon people who had no children, fumbled just as blindly for a glass and the faucet, and managed finally to swallow about 8 pills, hoping she could keep them down long enough to do some good. Rex said.
"I know it's too many. You don't have to tell me that."
She stood there, eyes still closed, still hanging on to the edge of the sink with one hand and her head with the other, trying to breathe normally despite the pain keeping all her muscles rigid and snatching at her ability to breathe at all, her stomach churning. The weird colors still swirling even though her eyes were closed, wishing pain meds took effect faster. Like, immediately. It would have been nice, she thought, to just take a shot of morphine and become unconscious for the duration. But she had discovered the hard way that both the law and doctors frowned on patients self-medicating, far less walking out the door of any hospital, clinic, or pharmacy with their own supply of morphine or any other industrial-strength painkiller. And besides, they said it was only migraines. Only migraines. Only migraines, Jesus. Even though no migraine remedy known to medical science and quite a few exotic possibilities Olivia had experimented with herself had so much as touched her periodic killer headaches, she fumbled blindly for the bottle again.
All right. I know there hasn't been enough time, but if the pain doesn't stop soon, I'm gonna take more. Shit!
A moment later, Rex hissed. Olivia managed to pry her eyes open no matter how much the ungodly brightness all around her hurt, and squinted at her cat in surprise. Because Rex didn't hiss, or at least never had. But as she focused on her rather odd-looking cat, his brindle torty coat at odds with the brilliant blue eyes of a Siamese, she realized even through the bright swirling colors, she was still seeing that Rex was scared. Really scared. And Rex didn't scare easily. Or at all. He was staring past her into the space behind her, the kitchen and den, and his pupils were so narrow that his eyes looked incredibly creepy, like the unnaturally blue eyes of a snake. The fur along his back was standing straight up, and his tail was about 3 times its natural size. At the same time, Olivia began hearing a strange rustling sound. At first, it sounded like dry leaves skittering along pavement, which was weird enough to hear inside her house with no pavement around. But then she realized it was whispering. Lots of voices. Lots and lots of voices. Whispering. It was coming from behind her. Olivia did not want to turn around. Her mouth was dry despite the nausea. Her skin was crawling unpleasantly. The pain in her head was getting impossibly worse rather than better. And she was afraid if she turned to confront an axe murderer, she'd beg him to just cut off her head and be quick about it. Axe murderer. Idiot. Not an axe murderer, of course. Not anyone. Not any one thing. Because she heard more than one whisper, many whispers, countless whispers. And she didn't know what they were saying, but she had the eerie feeling they were all whispering the same thing. The same words. Still holding the edge of the sink with one hand, Olivia turned slowly to see what so frightened her cat and was making her own skin crawl in a sensation she'd never felt before. "Oh, shit," she whispered. The headache that was still hellishly painful didn't seem such a big deal now, because despite all the swirling colors nearly blinding her, she could see very clearly why Rex was afraid. Every sharp object in her kitchen and den, every single one from every kitchen knife and fork she owned to 3 letter openers, 2 pairs of scissors, 2 box cutters with razor blades visible, the iron fireplace poker, and 6 pens and 2x that many sharpened pencils, floated in midair. Different levels, some low, some as high as eye level, with their pointy ends aimed right at her. And they were all whispering. "Ow," Rex muttered, his voice unusually quiet, questioning.
"I'm not doing it. I'd know if I were doing it right. I always know. I have to concentrate to do it. I mean, unless I'm mad. Angry, not crazy. Though maybe crazy, too. Maybe this is never... Anyway, even if I'm mad, I don't know how to make anything whisper."
Or how to stop it when she instinctively tried, an effort that was definitely not rewarded. Unconsciously, both her hands lifted to her head, pressing as if to hold something in, because the headache suddenly grew horribly worse, impossibly worse, dragging a guttural groan from somewhere deep inside her, and through the bright swirl of colors that was beginning to truly blind her, she could still see all the scary sharp weapons floating inexorably toward her. Whispering. What was whispering? Inanimate objects couldn't communicate, right? Not like this, at least. The pain edged into agony, but even so she heard as if from a great distance her own shaking, pleading question.
"What? What are you saying? What do you want of me?"
And from the same great distance, she heard the whispered demand that made no sense to her. "Prosperity. Go to prosperity." They were still floating eerily toward her, all the pointy things that promised even more pain if they came much closer, and hard as she tried, Olivia couldn't do anything about it, couldn't stop it, couldn't see anything but them or hear anything except for that whispered demand. Go to Prosperity. Go to Prosperity. Olivia heard one last thing. A moan of agony escaped her, and then everything went black. Tuesday, October 7. Logan Alexander considered himself a man of hard-headed practicality, which to his way of thinking was ironclad proof that the universe had a twisted sense of humor. Because he was also a medium. A medium. And he hated being a medium. He hated being called a medium, being dragged from peaceful obscurity into an unwelcome spotlight of sorts. What he was and what he could do named, if not understood, words spreading among those who scorned with suspicion and those who believed or desperately wanted to. Both always, always finding him eventually and making his life hell so that he'd have to pull up stakes again, usually in the middle of the night, and find another place to live, in another town or city or state where he could be anonymous again, just another stranger. And left in peace. Until the next time he was found, and the lost ones began to seek him out again. Not the, can you contact my Uncle George and ask him where he hid all the family money, sort of questions that only made him impatient. Those were relatively easy to either avoid or else respond to with some bullshit answer that would satisfy the sort of people who would even ask that kind of silly question. It was the truly lost ones that got to him, the religious who had lost their faith and needed proof of some kind of an existence after death. The parents, hollow-eyed and haunted in a very human sense by the inexplicable and heartbreaking disappearance of a child. The widows and widowers bereft by the loss of the other half of themselves. And others, so many others. Lost people who were desperately hopeful that he could help them. He hated it. But what he hated most about an ability way too many people with no understanding of what they were talking about called a gift or a curse, as if it could be anything so simple as either, was that he had absolutely no control over it. And he had been told by someone who did understand and should certainly know all about it that the door most mediums opened in order to communicate with the dead was, in him, always open. Always. Or, hell, just missing entirely. And also that mediums naturally attracted spirits, whether they wanted to or not. He didn't talk to the dead, certainly not willingly. They talked to him, anywhere, everywhere, no matter how hard he tried to ignore them. Persistent, insistent, often desperate, dogging his steps, showing up in different places, making it impossible for him to go out to dinner or to a theater and enjoy a play or movie, impossible to attend a party or even to date, or at least date the same woman more than once. He'd learned that lesson the hard way, with too many first dates ending with a woman eyeing him uneasily because he'd spent too much time sending brief, fierce glances at nothing she could see past her shoulder or over her head, or at the empty chair at their table. Most were either too kind or too wary to say it aloud, but at least one date had told him frankly that she didn't see the sense in a second date, since it was obvious he had more baggage than she did and she wasn't getting any younger. And the last time an instant physical attraction had cut an evening short for energetic, if not desperate, sex in his bed. The lady had left before dawn after waking to find him sitting up in bed having a whispered, but clearly angry argument with someone named Josephine. His bedmate's name wasn't Josephine. He was wide awake, and as far as the lady could see, nobody else was in the room. So she snatched up her clothing and ran. Logan had not blamed her one bit. He was just grateful that she hadn't called the police to report an escaped lunatic. At least a few before her had done something of the sort over the years, reporting him as potentially dangerous, or mentally ill, or just a man who had frightened them in an age when police were finally paying more attention to that sort of thing, leaving him to spend time in this jail or that detention room, or in some clinic or other, while the police and sometimes doctors got things sorted out to their satisfaction in the quest to determine whether he was actually a danger to himself or others. Sometimes there were fines, sometimes an order for a psychiatric evaluation, all because he could see and talk to the dead. They stole any chance he had of living a normal life, these spirits, and while his sympathy was sometimes roused by a particularly sad or frightened spirit killed in some brutally unfair manner and desperate for his help, he seldom could do anything to help them, and that only added to his resentment. At least most of them had had a shot at a normal life before whatever unfair act or illness or accident had put them in the ground. Logan, on the other hand, could hardly get a normal day to himself. Impossible to do everyday things. Wherever he went, whatever he was doing, there was at least one dead person anxious to talk to him. Like now. He was just blamelessly walking in the park near his current home in San Francisco, needing some morning air before he returned to the freelance IT work he did from his home office, because of course he couldn't work in a normal office setting with people all around him. Besides, even the living had begun to wear on his nerves after a while. Maybe especially the living. He had just wanted some air, that was all. And there was a dead guy walking beside him, talking to him. "She didn't mean to poison me, I'm sure," the older gentleman of about 60 was saying earnestly, for about the third time. Logan paused on an arched footbridge and leaned his elbows on the wooden railing, gazing down at the happily burbling man-made creek. A quick glance had shown him no one else was near, but he still kept his voice low. Bitter experience had taught him that, as with dates, office jobs, and lovers, speaking aloud in public to people only he could see whenever normal people were within earshot too often meant a quick trip to the nearest loony bin, or at least a night in a cell. Adding insult to injury, the cells, too, were always filled with dead people, usually far more hostile than his living cellmates. "Listen, buddy, my name is Oscar." Logan didn't bother telling him names didn't really matter. "Oscar, I don't know if your wife poisoned you. My girlfriend." Logan sent him a glance, mildly surprised, but shrugged. "Whatever. I don't know if she poisoned you, but if you're looking for justice, I can tell you from experience that cops take a dim view of dead witnesses communicating through mediums, and judges take an even dimmer view. And I've had more than my fair share of time on a shrink's couch, thank you very much. But were you buried or cremated?"
"Cremated."
"Then you're really out of luck."
"The medical examiner took samples of everything. I saw him."
He sounded suddenly a bit queasy. Logan felt the first flicker of sympathy, even though he didn't want to. This wasn't the first spirit who had shared details of his own autopsy. That had to be unnerving, to say the least, watching your own body being opened up on a slab.
"Must not have been anything conclusive enough to interest the cops," he said. "But that's the thing." Oscar sounded near tears. "They were convinced. They arrested her. They're going to put her on trial for murder. And I know she didn't poison me. But my wife hired a PI, and he's come up with a theory of how and why she could have done it. And I know he planted evidence and other stuff the police believe. Or maybe they just slipped me the poison and made it look like she did. I think they're both in on it. My wife and her PI, because I've seen them together, and I just..."
"Oscar, what do you want from me?" Logan tried his best to keep impatience out of his voice.
"My girlfriend doesn't deserve to go to prison. She didn't do anything wrong. She didn't poison me. And how do you think I can prove that? A glance showed him that Oscar was looking even more miserable. I don't know. All I know is that it isn't fair. Life isn't fair, buddy. Why should death be? But then the way Oscar's voice had broken off tugged at Logan's attention, and he looked at the spirit again. The spirit named Oscar seemed to be enveloped in a strange, multicolored aura, all the intensely bright colors swirling and dancing around him. Logan didn't see auras. What the hell? Oscar shook his head slightly, as though trying to throw off an unwelcome distraction, while at the same time his expression was straining as though trying to hear something. And then he looked frightened.
I don't... Oh, damn, there won't be time. Promise me, Logan. Promise me you'll come back here and help me prove Lucy's innocent.
Come back from where?
Oscar, prosperity. When you come back from prosperity.
A weird sensation of unease was beginning to crawl over Logan's skin, unfamiliar and distinctly unpleasant, and his head had begun to pound.
What are you talking about, Oscar? I'm not going anywhere. My job... You have to take a leave or quit or something. You have to go to prosperity, Logan. You have to help them.
Now he looked terrified.
We'll all be in danger if you can't help them stop it. The living and the dead.
Logan wondered abstractedly what sort of danger could or would trouble a spirit. Before he could even form the words to ask, Oscar and his rainbow aura vanished like a soap bubble. Decision out of my hands, Logan told himself with relief, ignoring the stab of guilt.
Nothing I could have done anyway, he muttered, straightening and turning to head back home.
After only 2 steps, he jerked to a stop and stood very, very still, only his eyes moving as he scanned the park in front of him. There were people moving around, just as there had been before. Couples holding hands, dog walkers, a couple of guys tossing a football, and another 2 throwing a frisbee. There were a few people on benches or just leaning up against a tree here and there with a book or tablet or laptop. Normal, even on a slightly chilly but sunny October day. What wasn't normal were the others, the spirits. They looked as real as the living, not transparent. But as his gaze rested on them one by one, he saw them shimmer, almost like heat off the pavement, or a jittery image on a computer, or special effects in a movie before becoming solid again. And every single one of them was just standing there, utterly still, turned toward him, staring at him. That was new. That was different. Logan turned in a slow circle, scanning as much of the park as he could see from his position. They were everywhere. Dozens, scores, more. A lot more. More than he'd ever seen in one place. Ever. As he completed the slow circle, he started in surprise to find one of the spirits standing only about 3 feet away. A woman. Too young to be dead. Though people did die young, and anyway, he had learned that he didn't always see spirits as they had appeared at death, but at some earlier stage of their lives. And he almost never saw what had killed them, spared at least that horror of nightmares of the living dead haunting him. He had no idea why. He didn't care. All he knew was that he was far colder than the October day, cold down to his bones, that the unpleasant crawly sensation roving over his entire body was getting stronger and more unsettling. His head was really hurting now, and a very strong sense of foreboding gripped him.
No, he said softly.
You have to go to prosperity, she said,
her voice a bit hollow and distant, as they were sometimes. Her face was without expression,
which was something else that was occasionally true of the spirits he encountered. This time, the total lack of expression on her face and in her voice was creepy as hell. Trying to hold his voice low and not betray to the living around him that he was a madman who saw what they didn't, that they were moving blithely about among spirits, too many spirits, nothing normal about that, even out on the paranormal fringes of his reality, he said, "I don't have to go anywhere. Leave me alone."
"They need you. We need you, Logan."
They always knew his name. It had always bugged him. "Tap another medium," he advised her. "It's gotta be somebody else's turn."
"You have to go. Please, Logan. It's so important."
"What?" But the half-formed question was never finished, because the spirit faded away quickly, and with an eeriness he'd never seen before, like she just became smoke dispersed by the slight chill breeze. It was a long moment before Logan could force himself to scan the park as he had before, but when he did, he saw no spirits, only the living, going about their business as they probably did every ordinary day of their nice, normal lives. "God damn it," he whispered. The day felt colder than he knew it was. Tuesday, October 7. Reno Bellman was congratulating herself for what had so far been a successful brunch date. She had not, after all, absently told her date, Jake Harper, any of the bits of information that had floated through her mind like flotsam on a calm sea since they'd met at this sidewalk cafe more than an hour earlier. She hadn't reminded him not to forget his mother's birthday next week, or told him his treasured high school football championship ring was not gone forever, but had instead rolled under his nightstand, or even that he was going to get that promotion he was anxious about. She didn't mention any of those things. Instead, she had chatted casually, just as Jake had, on the safe topics generally reserved for a first date. Likes and dislikes, the undoubtedly miserable winter looming ahead for Chicago, and how the Cubs had done during the season. They both tacitly avoided politics and religion, those trickier subjects more suited to later. If there was a later, when disagreements would either be handled amicably or else judged to be insurmountable differences. Everything was fine, just fine. So when she became conscious of a rustling sound like dead leaves skittering over pavement, she glanced around in surprise. This sidewalk cafe was moderately crowded for a Tuesday morning in October, but nobody else seemed to see or hear anything unusual, and she couldn't see any leaves or anything else skittering past. Reno was about to just chalk it up to her generally heightened senses when the rustle of dry leaves became instead whispering. Whispering by many voices. Or by something else. Something tugging at her with increasing insistence, causing the fine hairs on the back of her neck to stir, and the skin all over her body to go unpleasantly pins and needles. Her head began to hurt. Badly. "Reno?" At first, it was only whispering, just sounds that seemed normal and ordinary, the background hum of a busy city neighborhood. But then, slowly, she believed she detected a sort of pattern to what she was hearing. And then words. Words whispered by many voices, all saying the same thing. "Reno?" "Hush," she said absently, all but forgetting her date and the need to concentrate on listening. What was it? What were they saying? She wasn't sure at first, but slowly some of the static faded, and she was just able to make out words. Words that gradually became clearer.
"Come. Come to. Come to prosperity. They need you. We all need you. You have to come to prosperity."
"Reno?" She never found out if she might have heard something more, an explanation, a reason, something she could glean safely and peacefully, in warm daylight and without fear, without being touched by violence. Because in that moment, Jake reached across the small table and laid his hand over hers, before she could warn him. So he was yanked with her into the hellish maelstrom of a vision. And this one was bad. Anyone could have been forgiven for believing that where they were was literally hell. Or, at the very least, some acid trip or horror movie version of hell. All the worst bits of Revelation and Dante's Inferno, with even scarier stuff added in for horror fun. The air was full of a horrible smell and choking ash, and as Reno stood there looking around, trying to tell herself that this was no way worse than other visions had been, it became worse. It became a lot worse. The ash in the air thinned out enough to allow her to see more of her surroundings. Unfortunately. The heat was searing, the rotten egg smell of brimstone acrid, and the ash from unseen but roaring fires drifted down, and drifted up, and drifted sideways. The alien landscape, as far as the eye could see, was a sickly reddish-brown, with jagged rocks that looked razor-sharp and thick, muddy streams slopping between the rocks, and here and there a stunted, twisted tree, bare limbs charred and bent downward in defeated submission. And the creatures, dozens of them, more, dotting the raw landscape as far as she could see, crouched and standing, still or swaying back and forth, with a few curled up on the rocky ground making pitiful soft noises that were awful to hear and impossible to ever forget. They might once have been human, but looked deformed now, bodies twisted, limbs partially missing, their faces skewed, almost melted, the features blunted or open or missing. Some of them looked skeletal, but with burned flesh clinging to bones, crackling sounds audible as they shifted and turned. To stare at Reno and her forgotten companion, or to listen if they had no eyes, or maybe just obeying the blind and deaf but primitive sense of an unusual presence and possible threat in their horrific reality. "What is this place?" she demanded of the nearest creature. It did not answer, but cringed away as a shadow detached itself from a towering jagged rock and stepped forward toward Reno. She recognized it only because she had heard of shadow people, beings from the spirit realm, or even deeper and much farther away, that might have once been human in some distant past. But now, from everything she had heard whispered on what some wryly or mockingly called the psychic grapevine, the current thinking was that they were simply the human-shaped utter blackness of everything wrong, twisted, sick, perverted, and evil. The psychic spillover of horrors poured into a creepily recognizable shape. Pure, negative energy. As if they had been feeding for eons on the evil emotions and evil acts committed by humans. And maybe they had. Some people had called them demons. This one made itself taller, elongated, towering over Reno and the stunned, terrified date she had completely forgotten about. "Neat trick," she said to the shadow creature, tilting her head slightly to look up, but not otherwise moving. "Now answer my question. What is this place?"
"Hell,"
it answered in a croak. "No, this isn't hell," she countered immediately. "Been there." A laugh like dry kindling scraping together came from the shadow.
"This is your earth, Reno,"
it said in that scratchy, unused voice. She had been holding fear at bay, most of a lifetime of practice allowing her to keep it out of her voice and expression, because she knew that whatever and wherever this place was, she was here only in spirit. It was a vision. And in her visions, she had discovered, the bad ones at least, any fear from her gave the various beings she confronted power over her. and sometimes made it more difficult for her to escape the vision if things got dicey. But when the towering shadows said this was Earth, she felt a genuine jolt of horror.
What are you talking about? Some kind of war is going to do this?
The ugly landscape all around her certainly could have been the seared devastation of some insane nuclear conflict. Without the creatures, at least. Or maybe with them, too.
Not that kind of war. Not soldiers in uniform fighting for flag and country, dying on battlefields.
The shadow creature's voice was still inhuman, yet managed to be mocking as well.
A different struggle. Too much evil building unchecked for too long. Darkness, hunger, need. Gathering, growing stronger. Upsetting the natural balance.
Trying to think clearly, Reno said, I would have thought you creatures would love that. Why show me? I'm shown things I can change, always. The shadow laughed again, weirdly both scornful and anxious.
This is something you need to change. Need to stop, if you can. To prevent, if you can. Hold the line. Better for all if the boundaries between our worlds, our realities, are maintained. An occasional portal or door opened here and there is one thing. Releasing pressure, easing the strain. Natural. Normal. The way things are supposed to be. This is something else. A dead and burning earth is no more use to us than it is to you. And if you die, if you are destroyed, so are we. We need the chaos of humanity. The destructive fear and evil you create. The negative energy. We need to feed. To exist. We balance you. The universe demands balance. Go to prosperity, Reno. The very earth there is ready to heave itself open. To spill out evil even we can't absorb. Can't control. You must stop it.
What, alone?
There will be others. Those who need to be there with you are being called. Some already on their way. Balance, Reno. We all need balance if we are to survive.
Reno had more questions than she could count, but as quickly as the vision had begun, it was over. And she was sitting at a small table at a sidewalk cafe on a cool Chicago morning, breathing in fresh air, the weak October sunshine making her blink. She felt the death grip on her hand abruptly released, and looked up to see her date lurching to his feet. His face was pasty white, and though he tried several times, he was clearly unable to say a word. Damn it, there goes another potential boyfriend.
It's okay, Jake, she said wryly.
I don't expect to hear from you again. As for this little adventure, I'm sure you'll be able to explain it away somehow.
You're crazy,
he finally yelped.
I expect that'll do, she murmured.
And as he hurried away without a backward look, almost running, she called after him.
No, really, I'll take care of the check.
And then her worser self reared its head and she shouted,
And don't forget your mother's birthday next week!
By then, he was definitely running. The shout made the pain in her head worse, but she decided it had been worth it. She was being stared at by others at the cafe. She could feel it. But Reno ignored them all. After most of a lifetime, she'd gotten pretty good at that. No use trying to control what she couldn't. She summoned a waiter with a glance, asked for the check, then asked,
Can you give me the time?
She wasn't wearing a watch. The young waiter looked at the large watch on his own wrist and replied,
It's 11:45, ma'am.
Exactly?
Yes, ma'am. Your check, ma'am. He looked after her hastily departed date, clearly somewhat indignant on her behalf. Reno didn't notice. She glanced at the total printed on the check and placed several bills in the folder, covering the meal and adding a generous tip, then closed it and returned it to him.
Keep the change.
Thank you, ma'am. More coffee? She looked up at him, saw him, and blinked.
No, no thank you. I'll just sit here a bit, if that's okay.
Fewer than half a dozen of the sidewalk tables were occupied by now, in the lull between the departure of early brunch customers and the next wave of people wanting actual lunch, an exodus that had apparently happened during her vision, which had, she estimated, lasted little more than 5 minutes. Time was always different in a vision.
Of course, ma'am.
He silently retrieved her date's cup, saucer, water glass, and napkin, flicked a few invisible crumbs off the table with the napkin, and just as silently went away again. Reno reached up to rub one temple briefly, then dug in her casual purse, produced a small bottle of OTC painkillers, and swallowed several capsules with a sip of water.
Prosperity, she murmured.
After a thoughtful moment, she reached again into her bag, this time for her cell phone, grateful not for the first time that she was one of the few psychics they knew of who was able to depend on having a charged phone for a reasonable amount of time, just like a normal person. She could even wear a watch when she wanted to, something else many psychics couldn't do because of how they used energy. Someone had told her once it was because she was wholly a receiver, her own energy not the sort that would blast outward and interfere with electronics of any kind. Whatever, as long as it gave her an edge. She keyed in the single pre-programmed number and leaned back in her chair, staring at nothing as she waited for him to answer.
Bishop.
Hey there, it's Reno. Funny thing happened at brunch today. Reno said. Thought you might be interested.
2. Tuesday, October 7.
Oh, God.
Special Agent Tony Hart groaned, holding his head with both hands.
What the hell was that?
His boss, Special Crimes Unit Chief Noah Bishop, shook his own head slightly, then grimaced and lifted a hand to rub his left temple, where a rather exotic white streak stood out starkly in his thick black hair. He was far paler than normal, and his sentry-sharp pale gray eyes were darker than Tony had ever seen them, like tarnished silver.
Vision? Tony demanded. Because I'll swear I saw colors I've never seen before. I didn't pick up all that from you, surely.
He was a clairvoyant, though not a particularly strong one. Even so, he had been known to easily pick up information, experiences, and even emotions from other SCU agents, especially if they were broadcasting for some reason. Bishop looked down at the legal pad lying before him on the conference table in the room at Quantico, where the SCU teams usually met to discuss cases, and where he and Tony had been, in fact, going over several cold cases, as they regularly did, as evidenced by a dozen or so folders scattered on the table.
Not a normal vision, Bishop said finally, characteristically answering only one of the questions asked.
He looked at the pen in his right hand with a brief frown before dropping it into a cup of pencils and pens nearby on the table.
That's an oxymoron,
Tony said, scrabbling in the first aid case he had located in a cabinet.
Normal vision. Our kind, I mean. If we're out of aspirin, I'm gonna kill somebody.
Special Agent Miranda Bishop, walking rather carefully, came into the room just then, a legal pad beneath one arm, holding something in that closed hand and a large bottle of OTC painkillers in the other hand. She caught Tony's eye and tossed him the bottle.
Try these.
Thanks.
Miranda sat down beside her husband at the conference table and held out her closed hand, opening it to reveal several capsules.
Here, take these.
And before Bishop, notoriously unwilling to take anything that might blunt any of his senses, could shape a refusal, she added,
I know exactly what your head feels like. Take them. We both need to be able to think clearly.
Bishop looked at his wife's startlingly lovely face, now unusually pale, her electric blue eyes dark with pain, and he swallowed the capsules.
Beloved?
I'm all right. Getting there anyway. Was worried about our connection since I couldn't feel you there for a while. But as long as that's all right, then we're all right.
Yes, love. We're all right.
You couldn't feel me either, though, could you? While it was happening.
No, but we're fine now. Whatever that was, I don't believe it intended to damage us.
Noah, what's coming? Can it be stopped?
If it can be stopped, we'll do all we can to stop it. We've been warned, and a heads up from the universe is rare.
We weren't summoned. Not us, not directly.
No, but we were shown enough that I can't help believing we're meant to help those summoned. We have resources, experience, knowledge most of those summoned can't possibly have.
But we can't interfere.
Not once it really starts. Once they're in place and it all begins to evolve. But I think we have a little time before that. Otherwise, why the warning? Time to gather, to plan. Which means what we do in the next 24 to 48 hours is critical.
Yes. Darling, if we fail, if they fail,
then the world will see evil in forms only we've seen until now. Forms none of their armies can fight, none of their weapons can destroy.
It should have sounded melodramatic. It did not. Her hand found his beneath the table, their fingers twining together on his upper thigh. Because sometimes the physical connection of flesh to flesh was more comforting even than the very deep and very intimate psychic one. Tony, a handful of painkillers in him now and oblivious of the mind talk that Bishop and Miranda tended to limit with others around so as to avoid confusion, looked at the other two.
What was that?
He asked again.
I've never felt anything like it in my life.
Miranda looked at him.
What did you feel? Besides the pain, I mean.
Dizzy and sick, and like the skin was trying to crawl off my bones, he replied succinctly.
Then, going even more pale, he pushed himself back away from the table as he had before, rolling his chair rather than standing, and reached for a landline phone on a nearby shelf.
Shit, Kendra.
While he checked in with his very pregnant wife, who had only just gone on maternity leave, Miranda looked at her husband.
If that affected the whole unit,
they'll start calling in.
One of the few ironclad rules in the SCU was that if any agent experienced anything out of the ordinary that could even loosely be connected to their psychic abilities, they were to report in to base, meaning Bishop, ASAP. It was always his cell number, though most agents knew that wherever he happened to be, which could be literally anywhere in the world, he made sure he had close access to a landline or satellite phone, and that was where the call would be forwarded. Most powerful psychics could seldom carry a working cell phone for any normal length of time. With few exceptions, the more powerful the psychic, the quicker cell phones went dead, despite all the attempts by various brilliant scientists both in the FBI and elsewhere to figure out a way to fix that sometimes dangerous problem. Bishop leaned forward and reached out his free hand to the multi-lined conference phone on the table, keying in the pre-programmed command that would forward any call made to his cell phone to any of the 6 separate lines shared by the conference phone and 3 other landline phones set up permanently in the room. The phone Tony was using was one of them. Two more phones sat on small desks on either side of the door leading out to the hallway. The spacious room's other door led out to the SCU bullpen, visible through three large glass panes along that wall. The bullpen was currently occupied only by administrative staff, since all other SCU agents save those in the conference room were either away on leave, inactive for whatever reason, or else working cases scattered across the country.
"We'll need a fourth agent to help man the phones in here," he said almost absently. "At least, preferably SCU and not administrative."
"Galen's here today," Miranda said.
Bishop looked at her.
She nodded. "He's been in and out the last couple of weeks, while you were on the St. Louis case. Still closed down tight as a drum, but I think he's getting restless.
I heard he's run the trainee course several times, and he's been at the shooting range half a dozen times.
So though he hasn't gone anywhere near his desk, he's been around just about every day, making small talk, which we both know is hardly his way. This thing could be what it takes to bring him off official leave and back to the unit. Because if this is as bad as we saw, then we may need a guardian in the worst way, an experienced watcher, especially given who's been summoned, and always assuming they answer the summons.
She had placed her legal pad on the table before them when she had joined him, and now she pushed it toward him a few inches. On the pad were written, rather shakily, with her normally clear handwriting showing severe stress, three names: Olivia Castle, Logan Alexander, and Reno Bellman. Bishop barely glanced at the names, for the moment far more concerned about his wife.
"It hit you harder than it did me, beloved."
"I wonder why."
"My guess would be your connection with Bonnie. Your instinct is always to reach out and protect her, especially when something unusual and potentially threatening happens. It's instinct, deeper than thought. That moment of reaching out left you vulnerable to the sheer power of whatever this is."
Bonnie was Miranda's younger sister, currently on track to graduate early from the University of Virginia, where she lived on campus with her longtime boyfriend, Seth, who was in medical school there. And though both Miranda and Bishop did everything they could to provide a normal life for her and keep her far from the difficult and dangerous life's work they had chosen, Bonnie was a born medium healer, exceptionally powerful, and she possessed a very strong psychic connection to her sister, something not uncommon among blood siblings, especially in a family that had produced psychics for generations. And most especially, when they had only had each other for too many years after their family had been devastated.
"She's safe. I feel that. Not among the summoned, thank God."
"And I believe I know why. We'll find out soon enough about our own people, but my guess is that psychics with specific individual abilities were summoned with, perhaps, some others with similar abilities, not summoned because they're intended to be held in reserve."
"In case the first line of defense fails?"
"If this warning is due to some kind of attack or something we've never before dealt with, yes. We won't know until everyone checks in or is located, but I think most of them will at least call in,"
he said out loud.
"Especially if they experienced some version of what we saw and felt."
Bishop pushed the legal pad on the table in front of him toward her until it touched hers. On his legal pad were written the names Sully Maitland, Victoria Stark, and Dalton Davenport. Leaning an elbow on the table as she absently rubbed the back of her neck, Miranda studied the names on his legal pad.
"Not the same names I got, but all of them are high on the maybe-one-day list, some for years. People you've kept a close eye on. And the abilities of these six run the gamut and then some. But why untrained people,
lacking experience as well as unwilling or unable for one reason or another to be feds, cops, or other kinds of investigators.
There's always a reason, Bishop noted.
If we can only figure it out. Or if they can.
Her gaze was still on the legal pads.
Medium, telekinetic, seer and clairvoyant, empath. Did we ever come up with a definition for Victoria's ability?
No,
Bishop replied, adding rather cryptically.
And I'm still not convinced she has only the one.
I remember she refused to be tested.
Repeatedly. And since she has exceptionally strong shields, none of us could read her. Those shields could help protect her, but we can have no idea of her control or how her ability could change in the field.
That's true of all of them, really.
Bishop nodded slowly.
We always gain the best and most useful information on most psychics involved during multiple investigations over time. But these psychics haven't been tested in the field. They've been tested in trying to live ordinary lives, which was all most of them could cope with, and even that gave most of them problems. With the possible exceptions of Reno and Sully, I wouldn't say any of them lives normal lives. But in the field on this, it could all be so much worse for them. The situation is already radically different from anything we've encountered, and we barely know anything about it at this point. Nothing about what's going on or could be starting in Prosperity. How to fight it. What the cost could be. We can't predict anything unless there's another vision. Can't extrapolate from data because we don't really have any.
Miranda knew her husband too well not to know that he was deeply troubled by this unprecedented situation and the extreme, if undefined, threat they both knew it represented. But she also knew that only time and a successful resolution to whatever this was could really ease his mind.
Assuming a successful resolution could be achieved.
Calm, she said.
I have a hunch we'll have a lot more data once our people and the others begin checking in.
She kept her eyes on the legal pad, adding,
And rounding out the list is a telepath. When was the last time you talked to Dalton?
6 months ago.
How is he holding up?
Bishop made a sound that wasn't quite a laugh.
Not at all happy to hear from me. He was still living in Alaska, about as far away from people as he could get without going out into the wilderness and totally off the grid. And wary as he is, he doesn't want to be that alone.
So not quite ready to sacrifice civilization, she noted.
No. He has ties, whether he's willing to admit it. Ties he isn't able to completely sever, and he's holding on to the phone when he could have tossed it. So, not willing to disappear.
But you're sure he was summoned, like these others?
I'm sure he got the call, just like you're sure the people on your list got the call. Just not entirely sure if he'll answer it with anything but a grim no, at least initially. He spent most of the 25 years since he was a kid medicated to the gills, institutionalized, thinking if he was able to think clearly at all that he was crazy, and listening to doctors telling him almost daily that he was delusional. It really is amazing that he emerged from that sane.
I know you hope Diana could reach him, since she's the only one in the unit with a past similar to his.
Similar, Bishop said, but not the same. Diana's mediumistic instincts kept themselves alive and functional at a subconscious level from her childhood on, in spite of all the meds and so-called therapy, and her father's determination to fix her, or just control her. And she wasn't institutionalized.
Miranda said, You're right. It's almost impossible to imagine how Dalton came through that sane.
I'm not sure at all he believes he's sane.
Well, neither did Diana, for a long time.
Yes, and she wasn't locked away completely from anything like a normal life, or surrounded by people with real serious mental illnesses for years on end. At least her father never subjected her to that.
True. And her abilities were exceptionally strong at the subconscious level.
Yeah. But Dalton's a telepath. In him, the meds